Hey, Drew.
John. Hey, how are you? How you doing, buddy?
I'm all right. You know. Okay.
A couple of people had called me, asked to come check on you. Do you know that you're covered in blood right now?
Maybe.
Is that pig's blood?
Hold on. Yep.
I'm Drew.
And I'm John.
And you're listening to The Ourchive,
our ever-growing library of everything, 1 hour at a time.
Can you? You did that.
But
you did that well.
Yeah, man.
Have we talked about your ability to do that?
Can you not do this?
No, I can't.
Wow. Try it. You can't do that.
No, I can't. I can't watch. All right, you ready?
Yeah. You're okay. First of all, you're doing it all wrong. Don't screw your mouth around like that. Just normal mouth. Look at me. Look. Normal mouth.
Okay.
Finger goes in the mouth.
All right.
You're going to take your finger and press it against the corner of your mouth.
Okay.
Don't stop pulling your jaw in. Just.
Okay.
Okay. Close your mouth around it. Like this. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Why can't you do it?
I can't.
Everyone can.
All right.
No. You're way too far. Right at the edge.
Okay.
Yay! Hey! I knew you could do it. Oh, good job.
Thanks.
This is a show about Stephen King.
And the movie we referenced is...
Stand By Me.
Based on the work of Stephen King.
It's a short story, isn't it?
A novella.
Oh.
It's a novella.
What's the distinction?
That is a very gray area.
Yeah.
Somewhere in between... A novel and a short story.
Length?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I think it's easy for Stephen King to pull off a novella and there be a distinction because his novels are typically known for being so long that what would be a novel to anybody else is just a novella to him.
I feel like The Shining wasn't that long.
It was like 600 pages or so.
Really?
Yeah, it's a long book.
My memory is not of it being that long.
Well, it doesn't feel like it's long. That's the thing. If it's a good book, you don't realize how long it is.
Good point.
And a lot of his books are good books.
I think that he gets some flack. I think people kind of, at least especially in the later years.
Yeah.
He gets some flack for... churning out sort of bubblegum kind of books where you chew right through them.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You kind
of stuff. Not a whole lot of substance.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's had some ups and some downs. I mean, depending on who you ask, his greatest accomplishments were, you know, the first few things that he wrote. And then everything after that was not any good. But the thing is, his popularity has only increased.
Yeah.
You know, like he's more popular now than probably ever, at least in terms of like the number of people who have read his books or who are aware of who he is.
What do you know about Stephen King?
I was very, very into Stephen King for a while.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people go through a Stephen King phase.
I didn't.
I'm interested to find out how you managed to avoid the Stephen King phase.
Yeah.
But so here's, let me tell you a little bit about Stephen King. Well, I'll tell you about my introduction to Stephen King.
Okay.
I knew about Stephen King from the movies.
Yeah.
That were based on his books. I'd heard his name bandied about related to these. And the one that really hooked me was Pet Sematary.
The movie?
The movie. Yeah. I was 8, I think, when Pet Sematary was released, the movie.
Okay.
And I remember the trailer really freaking me out.
Yeah.
And I couldn't really entirely understand what it was supposed to be about, but I just knew it was creepy, and I liked the words Pet Cemetery. I was like, that sounds pretty nasty and sinister and everything.
Even at 8.
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, definitely. So,
say that as 8-year-old John would have said it.
Oh, yeah.
Like, okay, I'll do the trailer.
Okay.
And I've never seen the trailer, so I'll be making
this will be good,
up.
Yeah.
Pet Cemetery opening this summer.
Man, that looks creepy. And Pet Cemetery just sounds nasty. Cool.
John, what are you doing?
Nothing.
Are you watching?
I'm watching Small Wonder.
All right.
Can I get a robot?
No.
A sister? A robot sister?
No.
Okay. Can I go see Pet Cemetery?
What's that?
It's a movie. It's about what? Dogs and cats.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's kind of how it went down, actually. I don't remember if I saw the movie first or if I read the book first, but somehow my aunt found out that I was interested in Stephen King, and she had Pet Cemetery,
the book,
paperback, and so she gave it to me. I was probably
she threw it at you.
Yeah,
get out of here.
She threw the book at me. Yep.
Oh, thanks.
So I read the hell out of Pet Cemetery, and I don't know, just kept rolling with it. I read Salem's Lot next, I think,
okay.
And then I read Night Shift, which was a collection of short stories. And so for probably a good 2 to 3 years, I didn't really read anything except Stephen King, because he had written so much, right. So there was enough to read there. Yes. That is one major hallmark of Stephen King, is that he is prolific.
He writes and writes.
Crazily prolific.
When he's not writing, he's writing as Richard Bachman.
He did, yeah. So Stephen King, first book was Carrie.
Okay.
First published novel was Carrie. He wrote a lot of short stories, short, like, Tales from the Crypt-y stories growing up when he was a teenager and stuff. And a few of them eventually got published in magazines, but nothing, like, huge. And so he was, I think he was teaching at the time or working in a laundromat or something. Mm. And he would stay up at night and write short stories. And eventually he started writing this novel, which eventually became Carrie. Mm. He actually threw it away. He wrote, like, the first, I don't know, 50 pages of it or something and threw it away. And this is apparently totally true. He literally put the pages in the trash. His wife found them, started reading it, and said, "You should finish this." So he has several times over thanked his wife for basically establishing his career, because without that, it's hard to say. I mean, I find it hard to believe that he wouldn't have eventually found success anyway, just because he is so prolific. He just keeps churning stuff out.
Sure.
Eventually, one of those things is going to hit. But yeah, so he wrote a whole bunch of stuff really fast. Like a book a year, which was a little bit more than what the novel industry was used to. And at one point, I think his agent or somebody said, "You need to actually slow down. You need to stop, because we're saturating people with books."
Yeah.
So instead, what he did was he just published them under a different name. Yeah.
But everyone knew.
Not right away.
Oh.
No, he was in the process of writing another book. I think it, or maybe he had just finished it. Thinner was the last Richard Bachman book. And that came out right around the time, mid-80s, where somebody finally figured out who he was. And I can't remember exactly how they did that. But at some point, it was released. So in the foreword, I think, of the Richard Bachman story, it says something like, "This is the last Bachman book." There's like an epilogue or something from Richard Bachman's wife saying, like, "This is the final work. Bachman has been killed." Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Because the public now, you know, knew who he was.
Wow.
Or whatever, so.
He's been killed.
Which he later, this is the other thing about him. Stephen King turns anything into literary source material.
Okay.
So that whole Richard Bachman thing
became
the basis for The Dark Half, a Stephen King book in which a guy's alter ego comes back, or like basically becomes real.
Okay.
So it's sort of like, and I think the main character in it was a guy who had written as this other character.
Yeah.
he had this pseudonym, and the pseudonym comes to life. And of course, it turns out there was some backstory, like the pseudonym was actually his twin brother who had died in the womb or something. Oh man, there's a great scene. No, it's a Siamese twin. That's what it was.
Okay.
There's a great scene in the very beginning of the Dark Half, or maybe it's later in the Dark Half. Anyway, there's like a flashback or something, and you find out that they were operating on him. And like he had like this weird like brain thing, and the surgeons go in there, and like his brother's eyeball is like on his brain, and it like the doctor cracks open his head, and there's an eyeball in there, and it like wakes up and looks at him.
Gross.
Oh yeah, yeah. Gross. Very gross. Stephen King can do gross. Here is another thing about Stephen King. He will. This was stated in his book. He wrote an entire book on the horror genre. Okay. Which is where he made his name, in the horror genre. And he said that horror is the finest emotion. And so in his work, he always tries to horrify first.
Mm-hmm.
If he can't horrify, he's gonna try to terrify you, which is a little bit different. And he said, if neither of those work, he goes for the gross out.
Okay.
But he's really good at all three of them, I think.
Does he define those terms?
He does, but it takes like 500,000 words for him to define them. Another great thing in that book, this is called Dance Macabre.
And, the book?
The book.
Okay.
Something that sort of got this whole episode percolating in response to the space travel episode that we did. Your mom posted about her memory of finding out about the launch of Sputnik.
Yeah.
Which totally reminded me of the opening of Dance Macabre, in which Stephen King relays this story about how he was a kid. He was at like a Saturday matinee seeing, I think it was Earth versus the Flying Saucers.
Okay.
And the theater, they stopped playing the movie, and the theater manager comes running down the aisle and says, he announces, the Russians have launched a spaceship. Whoa. It's flying over our heads right now. And Stephen King said that is the first time he can recall ever being terrified.
That's awesome.
Yeah, which is such a cool story.
Wow.
Cool memory.
Is he still writing today?
He is. He's still writing, despite the fact that he retired several years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. He just can't stop. He just can't stop. But he's doing it a little bit differently. And this is one of the things where I feel like people who criticize his later output are maybe not taking into account the fact that, one, he's not really doing this for anybody else. He's doing it for himself, you know. But two, he's experimented a lot.
Mm.
You know, for a long time, he was basically just writing novels and short stories. And then he did the first ever sort of pay-as-you-go storyline.
Hmm.
This was back in, like, the late 90s. And it was like a download thing. It was like right in the early days of Amazon. He did this partnership with them he would publish like an installment.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like totally up to you. You could pay as you go. You could pay what you wanted. You'd say you could pay if you think this is worth it. You
okay.
can pay. And he recommended like $1.99 or something. Uh-huh. And he wrote, I think he wrote three installments. And at that point, no one was really paying. And he said, okay, so this is done, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If that's where this is going, then I'm just going to stop writing it. And so he did. But that was sort of the model that became that whole pay what you want
sure
thing that a lot of bands use now
and
creators and stuff. He wrote some audiobooks, like designed specifically for audiobook. He wrote comics.
Mm-hmm.
He's written stuff for Marvel.
Okay.
He's a song. He's not really a songwriter. He's a singer.
Band?
Yeah, we did. We talked about the Rock Bottom Remainders and the side bands, concept bands, and side projects. Yeah. And he's written and directed movies. He's written screenplays. He has directed films.
What did he direct?
He directed.
Oh no.
He directed Maximum Overdrive, which was loosely based on one of his short stories called Trucks. but there's a great scene. Speaking of that, there is an awesome scene in the very beginning. He makes a cameo. He frequently makes cameos in the movies of his work. But there's a great opening cameo in Maximum Overdrive where he goes to get money out of an ATM. Uh-huh. And this is right at the point where all of the machines on Earth start becoming sentient, you know, and rebelling. And he plays this sort of like hick kind of businessman, and he's standing at the ATM, and the ATM like starts messing with him, and he's like, "What?" You know, and pounding on the thing, and the little readout, the digital readout on the thing says, it like insults him or something, and he like turns to his wife and he says, "Honey, this machine just called me an asshole."
Under the octopus with the steamboats, ancient goblins and wallows come at the grand light making a sound. The smell of death is all around. And at night when the cold wind blows, no one cares, nobody knows. I don't want to be buried in a pet cemetery.
You missed the phase. How did this happen?
There's a couple reasons. The first reason is that, especially growing up, I did not like scary stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was very scared of scary stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I avoided the movies that were, you know, made based on his stuff, and mm-hmm. I didn't read any scary stories. But also, the other factor is, and I can't remember if it was both my parents, but it was, I definitely, my mom did not like Stephen King, and she would tell me how she thought he wasn't a good writer.
Wow.
And she got, I think she allowed that his early stuff was okay.
Mm-hmm.
But she said that she got sick of the fact that, and almost, I think it was my mom, maybe it might have been my dad who said this. One of them told me that they were sick of how in every book that he wrote, someone at some point would say, "This is like being in a Stephen King novel." and they, and that he was just writing books to be made into movies.
Oh.
And so that, you know, was another reason that I sort of like said, okay, well, I guess I shouldn't, you know, I won't bother with Stephen King.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't read a Stephen King book until probably college, where I took a class called Fantasy and Horror Literature. Yeah, Fantasy and Horror Literature.
I'm surprised you took this class. Well, I guess the fantasy side maybe was that.
Yeah. Well, okay. At this point, I wasn't scary stuff. You know, I still would avoid, but in as far as reading it, I was fine.
Mm-hmm.
It's visual that really I steer clear of for the most part.
Do you remember what book that was?
Yeah. I'll get to that because a couple books.
Oh.
Well, so this class, I mean, this will be a bit off tangent, but I feel like it's a good story, sort of. Brett and I took this class together, and it was through Merrimack Community College.
Uh-huh.
Though it was at the Forest Park campus.
Oh.
No. No, it wasn't. It was at a different campus, but it was Merrimack Community College.
Okay. All right.
And we took it because, like, oh, horror, fantasy and horror literature. Like, this will be cool stuff to read.
Yeah.
And it was one of these classes that I think it only happened twice a week. And it was like a 3-hour class, or maybe it was once a week and it was super long.
Mm.
And we get there and she passes out like the syllabus, which has the reading list, what we're going to be reading that year. And it's all horror. There were no fantasy films whatsoever. Her fantasy books. And I say films because we watched the movies in every class. She would assign a book, you know, and then we'd watch the movie. And we would watch the movie before finishing the books.
What?
Yeah. And we, so Brett and I would sit in the back And his class was sort of full of misfits. and like people were just not the sharpest in that class. And there was one dude who, which his name was Leto. L-E-T-O.
That was his first name?
Leto. Huh. I don't know. That's
what he went by.
And the great thing is, like, for just some Leto. Reason, the professor, like, latched onto this kid. And she'd be asking. And what she would do, her sort of thing would be we'd be having a discussion in quotes. And she would be like, and so what does everyone think he meant by this, Leto? She'd always like grab someone's name, and it would seem more often than not that Leto.
It was always Leto.
Yeah, yeah.
Did Leto have good responses?
No, like, no.
No.
Leto was great though. Leto was sort of this like thugged out white dude. And he was constantly not paying attention, and he didn't have any good. No one in that class had good answers. They were really a class of idiots. And Brett and I would just sit back and sort of like in wonder and awe of this. However, that was the first time that I read Carrie and The Shining. And so we watched both of those movies in the class as well.
Wow.
Yeah. I think I had seen The Shining at that point. But I hadn't seen Carrie. But I wasn't like blown away by either book, but I remember thinking, well, this is good, you know. I don't think but it wasn't good enough. At least I didn't enjoy it enough to like seek out more of his stuff later on.
I think those are pretty good selections. I would argue that they are among his best.
Mm.
The Shining, definitely. I think
The Shining.
The Shining. Quiet boy, you want to get sued? The Shining was the one that everybody always told me, like when they would find out that I was in my Stephen King phase, they would always be like, "Oh, have you read The Shining yet?" And then be like, "No," and say,
"Really?
Yeah, you need to read that one."
You hadn't read it yet?
I feel like, well, eventually
Were
I did.
You building up to it?
No, I was just sort of I was taking whatever I could get. You know, I would go to like a used bookstore nearby and just I would have $3 or whatever, and so I would buy whatever they had there that I hadn't read,
right?
And it just took a little while for The Shining to, you know, to come to me. But I don't want to talk too much about The Shining the movie, because I think it's sort of a different beast. But the book is really where I think he really sort of cemented his reputation, because that one, you could argue that there's greater value in Carrie or Salem's Lot, which was his second book, beyond just being horror stories. Mm-hmm. But I think The Shining is where he really wove in something a little more literary, in that it's not just about the haunted house. It's sort of a story about a guy dealing with alcoholism and his own, what he's doing to his family, you know, which apparently was inspired by Stephen King's own experiences. Like, I don't think he beat his children or anything, but I think he sort of had trouble with alcohol. And actually he admitted sometime like maybe 10 years ago or something, like he was a huge addict for a long time. Like, not just alcohol, but he was doing cocaine and all this stuff. And ironically, like, the period in which he was doing this is when, like, arguably some of his best stuff was written. Yeah.
Of course.
He said something like he doesn't even remember writing Cujo. Like,
wow.
Which is like one of his most popular books. Those are really good ones. And I think he started to get popular almost right away based on the movies, because I think the movie of Carrie came out like 2 or 3 years after the book. Mm-hmm. So it was a pretty quick turnaround, and it's a pretty great movie. But yeah, so almost immediately he had that association with the movies where anything that he was making was going to get turned into a movie.
You know what's weird about that Carrie movie? Here's what's weird about it.
Tell me.
You've got Carrie, right? And she's like, you know, the sheltered young teenager, sort of coming of age and dealing with issues. And she's being put upon by, like, the cool kids, right? But one of the cool kids is a total dork. The girl who's always wearing a baseball cap.
PJ Souls.
Oh, I cannot stand Norma. Her.
Really? Oh, I love... I have a huge PJ Souls crush.
Why?
She was in everything, man. She was great.
I don't care about the actress. I mean, that character is terrible.
Yeah, okay. There are some...
Here's the problem. I don't believe... I don't buy her as, like, part of the cool kids group. She would be made fun of, too. She's constantly wearing that stupid hat. And she's dumb.
There were certain liberties, I think, taken in that film that may have not done a service to the legitimacy of the storyline.
Yeah.
But what I do like about that story, especially in the book, I think this is conveyed much more in the book, is like how arbitrary everything is. You know, like no one really has a vendetta against Carrie until they feel put upon.
Yeah. You know?
Like it's, I think in most stories of that scenario, like people, they just pick on somebody because they're the cool person and the other person is the nerd or whatever.
Yeah.
And I feel like the escalation of things feels very realistic to me in that storyline, in that, you know, she has this horrifying experience and they all, the sort of popular pack of girls,
jump on it.
Yeah, they just sort of seize upon it as an opportunity, and they're like being thoughtless. They don't
sharks.
Yeah.
Smelling blood in the water.
Ooh. Ooh. It's a little too apt, maybe. But they, you know, they don't really necessarily mean anything malicious by it. They're just joking around. They are not perceiving that it's as bad as, you know, for Carrie. But she is, right. She thinks she's dying.
Yeah.
And they're laughing about it. And so they get punished for their actions.
Yeah.
And that's when the tide turns, and that's when it becomes more like an aggressive thing.
And doesn't she get punished by her mom?
Yeah.
For that, I mean, she gets punished by her mom for everything.
Yeah, she's in a pretty terrible situation. Yeah. She has like no friends,
no
you
support,
know?
And except for the teacher, right? I mean, isn't there a teacher sort of like?
Well, yeah,
she's not really like.
You get the feeling that the teacher has an agenda too.
Yeah,
you know, like this is maybe either her working out some of her frustrations as an adult with these kids. Like she has sort of a grudge against the popular kids. And there's also a little hint that, you know, maybe she was trying to take advantage of Carrie, you know? So there's a lot of stuff there. Anyway, she's not considered like a,
no, she's not
legitimate friend to Carrie, you know?
No one is.
No. They aren't. That's the tragedy of it.
Yeah.
The great book, because there is no hero in it, really. Yeah. You know, and there's no clear cut villain either.
Yeah.
I mean, there's definitely like sort of an instigator on the side of the popular kids, but and this is another thing that I have I have problems with a lot of interpretations of that story. Like that whole storyline became the model for a lot of ripoffs like throughout the 80s and 90s in movies. And I'm the one thing that really concerns me about this new Carrie is that it will go even further into this regard, which is to treat her like an anti-hero. I understand that tendency.
Yeah.
You know, she's sort of portrayed as an underdog.
Yeah.
Or can be that character type can be easily identified with as an underdog, but her actions, you know, she's responsible for her own actions in the course of that storyline, and she lashes out.
Well, I feel like in the movie, because that's my memories mostly of the movie, I feel like it portrayed it well in so much that when she lashes out, it doesn't, like, I didn't find myself like cheering her on.
Yeah.
I was, you know, kind of horrified by it, you know.
Yeah, which I think is what you're supposed to be.
You sort of like, you wanted her to get back at them,
yeah,
but you didn't want it to go as far as it did.
Yes. Yeah.
Everybody's got the shining. You're shining, I'm shining. Everybody's got the shining.
In the Overlook Hotel, he went to write a book but ended up going to hell. His wife Wendy tried to calm him down, but for her trouble nearly got an axe in her crown. Their son Danny had a special gift, but how's it gonna help with all the blood in the lift? Can't the little kid just play on his trike without dead twin sisters giving him a fright? Yeah.
The shining, the shining. Everybody's got the shining. You're shining.
Didn't he write, and I haven't read or seen any of this, but didn't he write The Dark Tower?
Yeah. That's considered sort of his magnum opus.
Right.
He started writing that when he was a teenager. I think at times he wanted to step away from it. I think it became too big for him.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a fantasy epic.
Yeah.
But it's a weird fantasy epic.
What's it about? Can you tell me?
Yeah. So in a nutshell, The Dark Tower is... The main character of The Dark Tower is Roland Deschain, the last surviving gunslinger of this sort of society that has moved on. It was kind of a feudal society, and he was the son of the king, the last king before what the terminology that they use is like the world moves on.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this world in which the gunslingers inhabit is sort of an alternate dimension that has parallels to Earth, to our world. And in the first book, The Gunslinger, he introduces the idea that these worlds can cross over. Mm. People can cross over.
Okay. Them.
So that's what the series basically is the plot line is a lot of crossing back and forth between these worlds and characters from various worlds coming into and out of each other. But the quest that he's on is to find this place called the Dark Tower,
mm-hmm.
and confront a character called the Crimson King.
Oh.
Who is, I think initially he believes that he's responsible for killing his father and basically destroying civilization.
Okay.
And the Crimson King is really like he shows up in different forms in a lot of Stephen King stories.
Oh.
This is another thing too with his books. He has a lot of the similar motifs that carry over into different stories, completely
carry
independent stories.
Over?
Oh.
They carry over.
No, they don't.
Is it
they
like
shine.
A What?
They shine.
They shine. Is it like a universe?
The Dark Tower thing?
I mean,
yeah. He has
oeuvre.
His own universe. Yeah.
Yeah.
So a lot of his characters will have, like, main characters from one book will have bit parts in other books.
Okay.
Yeah. But in addition to that, then he also has this Dark Tower universe, which is independent of the real world Stephen King universe.
Okay.
But it intersects with it.
Yeah.
So there are the Dark Tower books. There are 7 Dark Tower books. No, I take that back. Now there are like 9.
Okay.
He's written a whole bunch more.
Are they done?
Sort of.
Okay.
Not entirely, because he keeps writing them.
Yeah.
The original storyline, he eventually said the Dark Tower series is 7 books, and that's it. But even in the course, before he had even published those 7 books, he was making allusions to the storylines or further storylines within other books.
Okay.
So a good example is one of what I think is one of his better later books is called Hearts in Atlantis.
Mm-hmm.
And it's 5 stories, I think. And one of them in particular involves characters from the Dark Tower coming into our world and in pursuit of somebody.
Mm.
And that was published 15 years before the final Dark Tower book came out. And now even though that storyline has concluded, he's going back to that world now. And mm-hmm. I think he just published one that's like a prequel,
mm-hmm.
Or, you know, set within the, it involves characters from that original storyline.
Mm-hmm.
But so the archetypes and motifs that he continues to work with, one of them is this sort of cyclical villain character,
mm-hmm.
Who is embodied in the Crimson King in the Dark Tower books. In The Stand,
mm-hmm.
he is Randall Flagg. He's sort of the devil incarnate, I guess. Mm-hmm. He's a very he's sort of a jester type character.
The Stand, didn't they make a movie?
Or they made a miniseries
with what's his face?
Gary Sinise.
No.
And Rob Lowe.
No. I thought what's his face is in it. The kid who played in Growing Pains.
Kirk Cameron?
Yeah, wasn't he in it?
In the stand? No. No. Molly Ringwald was.
Oh. Was it good?
You know, man, The Stand, that was like a huge deal mm-hmm. when it came out. I remember that. It was the kind of thing where like no one really believed they could ever make an adaptation of The yeah. Stand because it was such a huge book. But they did it, and I thought at the time they did a really good job.
It came out in the '90s, right?
Yeah, 1994. I remember it exactly when it aired because it was the end of eighth grade for me.
Wow.
And it was the week.
You were like, this is it.
Oh yeah.
Like school's out.
Ready to watch The Stand.
The Stand's in.
I had read The Stand every year, once yeah. a year, for like 2 or 3 years at that point.
Wow.
And I continued to do this. I've read The Stand like 8 times.
Wow.
And I always, see something else. It's not my favorite, actually. But so I was really excited about the Stand miniseries.
Yeah.
And the night the final installment aired,
yeah.
I was on my class trip. And I remember
senior class or eighth grade class trip.
Okay. Yeah. We went to Chicago.
All right.
We took a day trip to Chicago. And I remember we were on our way to the airport to fly back.
Yeah.
And we're in on this bus, it's just our class on this bus. And they've got TVs going and they're tuned to ABC.
Oh, wow.
And The Stand is about to start.
Now, had you seen the other parts?
I've been watching all of them. I was caught up at this point.
Yeah.
And so I'm ready for the last installment. And I think, oh, this is great. I get to watch this on the way to the airport. And like as it's starting, the driver flips off the TVs and then starts saying, "Over to the right is the Polish part of Chicago. The Polish part of Chicago has been here since 1854."
And
proceeded to give us this like interstate tour of Chicago. I mean, we're not even seeing anything, you know, and it's nighttime.
Wow.
Yeah. Horrible. I was so angry. So upset, but I eventually did watch it. Yeah.
Wow.
And it's really not that good.
How did you eventually see it?
Well, I recorded it. I had my dad taping it or something at home. Yeah. I'm pretty sure I called him like twice that day and was just like, don't forget The Stand.
And it was good when you watched it. Like you can remember enjoying it.
Yeah. I liked it.
Sort of. Did you ever come back to it?
Yeah, I think I tried to watch it a couple of years later, and I was like, no, this isn't really good. The thing about it, like, my favorite chapter in The Stand has nothing to do with any of the other characters. Mm-hmm. It's just, like, sort of the world breaking down.
Uh-huh.
And that was really not conveyed very well in the miniseries. It's sort of like things are breaking down at the end of one episode, and at the beginning of the next episode, it's gone. Everybody's gone. Yeah. I guess we should say The Stand is sort of an end of the world scenario. There's this.
I've never seen or read it.
It's a super flu that the government develops and it gets loose and it wipes out 95% of the population.
Yeah.
And then the remaining population ends up kind of congregating in two camps. One of them is, you know, trying to rebuild and correct the mistakes of the past. And the other one is basically just building up an arsenal and readying themselves for war.
Stand by me.
Nicely done. That was a very smooth
segue.
Transition.
When the night has come and the land is dark
and the moon is the only light we'll see. No, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand by me. So darling,
Stand By Me was based on The Body.
I've never read it. The Body.
Really?
Mm-mm.
It's good.
I feel like you wouldn't even need to, though, because that movie is so good.
Actually, it is such a good adaptation. It's one of the most faithful adaptations, I think.
I've been sort of reminiscing on that movie since you and I were talking about it a little bit last week.
Yeah.
And I've just been like realizing how great a movie it is. I think it's because it's so simple, and it's well acted, and it's a movie about an adventure like these kids go on, mm-hmm. that doesn't have any there's no paranormal stuff, there's no magic stuff, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, it's completely grounded in reality.
I couldn't even see this movie being made today in any way, shape, or form. Like a movie about kids, where I mean, well, maybe, but like, and I'm trying to think. Like, I guess Stand By Me wasn't geared towards kids.
No, it was an adult.
But
story.
I watched it when I was a kid.
Yeah, I feel like everybody in our generation sort of gravitated towards it.
Well, it had it had River Phoenix in it.
Yeah,
it had
Will Wheaton.
It had Jerry O'Connell and
Corey Feldman,
and like these are four kids who I think our generation were pretty familiar with.
Yeah, definitely Corey Feldman at that point and River Phoenix.
Yeah.
I think that was, first movie, but it was.
And I think that was before Star Trek, so I don't think Will Wheaton had done Star Trek yet. But like they had these really, I think, compelling, you know, kid actors, right? And so like I think it was like really. And plus the movie, like you hear the premise and you're just like the kids in the movie. Like, I want to see that.
Yeah.
You know, and it has like this, I think what I'm impressed by is how kind of scary it is. And like, but it's on the surface of things, it doesn't seem like it would be scary, but the situations they get into are very real. And there's this vibe throughout it of like sort of danger, like something could happen, you know? And there's, I think, lots of really good moments in that movie where it's all stuff that's real and yet feels magical.
Yeah, there's you really get the sense that they have made a journey in the course of that movie. You know, really, I think they were only like going 10 miles or something like that. They weren't really going that far geographically, you know? But like you really get the sense that they are completely different people at the end of it. Like they have learned all these things about themselves, and it's not like you were sort of saying the other day that it's a really scary, dark scenario that they go into.
Yeah.
And it's kind of thing when you're watching it as a kid, you're just along because it's an adventure.
Yeah.
You know? Like, you're like, oh, okay, kids on their own.
Yeah.
Traveling, you know, with a goal in mind.
Yeah.
And it like that was such a thing for those movies like at the time, like The Goonies.
Yeah.
You know, like it's basically like a less jolly Goonies. You know, I mean they don't
especially with the ending.
Yeah. Yeah. They, but it really is. It dawned on me when we were having that conversation how dark that ending actually is.
Yeah.
And so they really do like sort of confront mortality.
Well, and it's a quiet thing too. Like
and I
can remember, like I think back to when I watched it. You know, I don't have like a specific memory of this, but you know, I don't remember being like. You know, the story, if you don't know, like these four kids decide, like one of them finds out that a kid was killed.
Yeah. He overhears his older brother talking to this other teenager and saying, hey, there's this kid.
Yeah,
and
there's a body.
Yeah, and I think that there's like a reward or something for it. Yeah.
They're trying to find it or something.
Yeah, the kid's been missing, and there's a reward for finding him. Yeah.
And so they go, and basically the four kids of the movie go to see the body.
Yeah.
Right? So they want to see a dead body.
And well, I think, and they want the reward, too. I think they have plans for that.
I don't actually remember the reward.
Maybe I'm making that up, but I thought there was.
They go, and, you know, they find the body, and I remember, well, I don't remember it, sort of impressing upon me at the time, like that, you know, they're looking at a dead body here. I think I was kind of desensitized to that or just not really processing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think back to that and like now I think about that and, you know, if I were a kid on that sort of journey and that was the end point, you mm-hmm. know, like, God, that's so grim and sort of,
it's brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't, I think part of the thing, maybe this is explains kind of the distance that you have initially, like you never see that kid as a character in the storyline, you know,
exactly.
You only know him as a dead body.
Yeah.
So it doesn't immediately, you're not hit with that emotion of like, oh, what a sense of loss because you haven't seen this person alive. But the more you think about it, especially in those final moments, you know, and in particularly the way that that climax resolves, mm-hmm. And so it's so powerful, and like the quietness of it, I think makes it even more unsettling. It's not like this this, you know, bombastic conclusion. Yeah, but you feel threatened. You know, they take basically this really commonplace scenario of just, you know, a bunch of kids picking on another set of kids, and they turn it into this really threatening, horrifying scenario.
It's a fun, like, it's weirdly fun and creepy and,
And
like, I have positive memories of that movie despite it being kind of a creepy film.
I think what they do really well in both in the book and in the movie, where they it's a convincing group of friends.
Yeah, it
you
is.
Know? Like, they genuinely capture that camaraderie.
They got that treehouse.
Oh, they did. They had the clubhouse. Yeah.
Well, then there's the teenage group too, who are like
Ace. Yeah.
Just, you know, which one's brother is it? Is it Will Wheaton's older brother?
No, it's Jerry O'Connell.
Oh, it's Jerry O'Connell's older brother?
I think. Was it? Yes. Yeah. Because he overhears it because he's under the porch. he's under the porch.
He's trying to find.
He buried pennies. That's what it is. He buried a jar of pennies and he's trying to find them. He doesn't remember
it's
where
so
he buried them.
Because there's those little, like, they feel so real.
Yeah.
And
yeah, he totally.
Kiefer Sutherland's the main.
He's kind of the leader of the teenage gang. Yeah.
And he kind of faces off with Will Wheaton. Doesn't
he? Yeah.
Because I think, you know, like the River Phoenix's character would maybe style himself as the leader of their group,
mm-hmm.
but I think Will Wheaton was really the.
Yeah, it's interesting that
heart.
It's sort of told from his perspective, the Will Wheaton character's perspective, even though I think there's never any doubt that the I can't remember what his character's name is now. But the River Phoenix character is sort of
he's sort of the catalyst. He moves them forward, I think.
Yeah.
The best the scene that sticks out in my head is scaring the crap out of me for no apparent reason is the story they tell around the fire about the pie eating contest.
Mm-hmm. The revenge of lard ass Hogan.
Oh, it's so creepy. I don't know why it creeps me out. I think it's partly because, like, they sort of, the people, you know, they actually show it. Like, it's part of the movie where they cut to.
Yeah, they depict the story.
And, like, the people are all weird looking and, you know, like.
It's like, it's sort of, the whole thing is kind of grotesque. Like, the characterizations of the people is kind of grotesque.
Is River Phoenix telling it?
No, Will Wheaton is.
Will Wheaton is telling it? And, like, he tells it in, like, such a creepy way. Like, you think something really bad's going to happen. And, like, and you know, when you, if you just describe to someone, it'd sound lampoonish, you know? Like, the way, or like a cartoon. But it stuck with me so much, so vividly. It's weird. That's the part of the movie that probably creeps me out the most.
That always bothered me, and the leeches always bothered me.
Oh, my God,
yes. When they jump in the lake.
There's so much happens in that movie.
Yeah.
There's the leeches. There's the train when they're on the bridge.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He drops his comb.
Yeah.
Yes! That's such a great scene. Oh, man. He's like, you forgot the food. I brought the comb. Oh, great. You brought the comb. You don't have any hair.
There's the they going through the junkyard or whatever.
Yeah, the dog. Yeah, with Chopper.
Yeah. Yeah. There's the campfire scene. There's the what else is there? Am I missing anything?
The one that I think it's sort of unsung, but like there's a part in there where. I think it's toward the end, where it's just Will Wheaton and River Phoenix who are awake, I think. Mm-hmm. And throughout the course of the story, you get these flashbacks of Gordy, the main kid, Will Wheaton's character, his relationship with his brother, who's dead now.
Yeah.
And he clearly feels that his dad just doesn't like him as much as he liked his older brother. You know, his older brother could do everything right, and Gordy just doesn't. And there's a part where he confides in River Phoenix's character that is so gut-wrenching. And it's not like... Nothing really happens there.
Yeah.
But in a way, it's sort of the climax of that story, you know, where he comes to terms with his relationship with his dad.
I feel like you see fewer movies these days. Like so, you know, the relationship between boys, you know, like childhood friends who are male. it's a tricky kind of story to tell because, you know, as a kid, as a boy, you kind of don't tap into those feelings or you don't understand them. And, you know, I think few films really attempt to like find that moment that feels right and feels organic. And, you know, I think Stand By Me does it more than once, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like
repeatedly.
The whole movie is kind of like this amazing depiction of that mindset. And, I feel like these days that relationship is treated more like not necessarily as a joke, but just like it's used for comedic purposes more so than it is for like kind of poignant moments.
And it's handled cartoonishly.
Yeah, yeah. I think the closest I've seen someone get was actually in the movie Superbad, where at the end of the movie, Jonah Hill and Michael Cera's characters sort of have a moment that's I think really touching. You know, and it wasn't played for laughs or anything like that. It was a genuine moment between like these two friends that, you know, you rarely, I think, see played in earnest.
It's a hard sell, I think.
Yeah.
Like people don't necessarily want to go there.
Yeah.
You know, or they don't know how to deal with that, you know? So I think most people shy away from it or it ends up being, you know, like. It's the type of movie that doesn't get seen by, you know, it's like an art house movie or something. But this was like huge. Stand By Me was enormous when it came out.
Those four kids, you end up feeling like they have this incredible bond, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's the thing, something I think Stephen King, what's one of the themes that he comes back to a lot is that adolescent group, especially in It. It is like a spiritual companion to Stand By Me, I think, in a lot of ways. Because I think they were written right around the same time. The Body was the story that it was based on. And in It, like it's flashes back and forth between present day and 30 years prior, and this group of misfits who sort of found solace in each other.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And like they're the only ones who are able to defeat... initially the thing that's, you know, attacking the town because that common bond that they have that's the only way they're able to beat it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of weird. I don't want to get into it too much, but the way in which they ultimately defeat it. It's unsettling in a lot of ways, but I think he really balances the stuff that's appealing about adolescent characters.
Yeah.
You know, the sort of the sense of humor and the familiarity that we have with that experience.
Yeah.
And he balances it out with all of the stuff that we don't like about it and all of the stuff that makes us uncomfortable. And he blends those together really, really well.
Yeah.
And I think that maybe is part of the reason why, kind of bringing this full circle, why I think a lot of Stephen King's books appeal to people when they're adolescents, you know, like they do, I think in a weird way, they are sort of a catharsis, you know, I always thought his writing in particular was comforting, that he depicted events from a perspective that I understood.
Yeah.
Like the thoughts that characters would have felt legitimate and felt real to me, like things that I had thought about.
Yeah.
You know? So I think it's very easy to get into his books if you're of that mindset.
I think we would be remiss if we didn't talk about The Mist.
Our perennial favorite,
yeah.
The Mist.
Which I think we talked about before.
We did. We talked about the movie. We didn't talk so much about the story. Similar.
When did we talk about it?
I don't remember. The Creeps, maybe?
Oh, maybe it was The Creeps.
The Creeps. I think we talked about the spiders and everything.
Yeah.
The book, that's a novella. It's another short novel. Is very similar to the movie.
Yeah.
There are a few characters that are a little different here or there, but it's pretty.
The ending isn't as grim, right? In the book,
it's much more open ended.
Like
they hear something on a radio. Uh-huh. Like they sort of run out of gas. I think they take up they hold themselves up in a hotel or something, mm-hmm. and they hear something on the radio. They don't know what it is. Yeah. It could be a human voice, or it could just be a creature or something. So it's sort of left up in the air. I have heard that Stephen King was so impressed with the movie that he wished that he had done that ending.
Yeah. What an ending.
Yeah. Oof.
Gut-wrenching.
Ugh.
And I think about that. I mean, the thing is, like, that enters my mind maybe, like, I don't know, maybe not this frequent, but I want to say, like, once a week, like, that'll hit me where I'll think about, God, what if?
What if you're in that scenario?
Ugh, I couldn't. I just couldn't do it.
Well, this thing, I don't want to like dig up this argument again, but I feel like that movie gets so much flack, you know?
For the ending?
For the ending. Now, I understand the thought that I will not lend credence to is the idea that, well, it's just a bad ending, or I don't like that ending, so it's a bad movie.
Right.
I don't believe that is a legitimate complaint. Agreed. You know. Now, a lot of people will say that they don't feel that the character had reached the appropriate level of desperation that he would actually go through with that.
Man, I do.
But I do too. And I also think that in a way is not the point of the movie. The point of the movie is to horrify you.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much the most horrific scenario that I can imagine.
Yeah. You know?
And then that way I think it is the most successful horror movie I've seen in years.
I think that he does get to that point in that, you know, they spend however long in this store, you know, surrounded by the mist, and like anytime anyone makes a foray out into it, something terrible happens, you know, they're either killed or, you know, nearly killed or see something horrific or whatever. Right. So there's like no safety. And I think it, you know, it hits me personally on a level to where that the mist itself kind of reminds me or is similar for me to like ocean, you know, like being in deep waters and you can't see far, you know? Mm-hmm. And so who knows what could be there, that anything could be in there, you know, like feet away from you.
Yeah.
And so that really hits on a point of terror that is in my mind. And so when they get out there, at the end of the movie, and there seems to be nowhere to go or nothing, you know, no way out. Like, I totally get how he gets to that point, you know, and sort of, and it's just terrifying and horrible.
Yeah.
But the movie itself, I think, is, you know, up to that point even is great, you know?
Yeah.
Like, there are these movies that in my mind feel so contained and kind of like small and well, like, well designed, like everything fits together in a way that I really like. Attack the Block is one of those movies. The Mist is one of those movies. Trying to think of other examples.
Sort of like where it immerses you in a fairly convincing universe.
Yeah.
You know, it's a limited universe, but it's fully realized.
And I feel like there's no fat, you know, everything's been trimmed and is just so, and like, you know, it's been tied up and put in front of me, and like, here's this little thing, you know, and you're gonna go into it and come out of it, and everything will be everything you want will be in there when you get out. And so The Mist feels like that kind of movie to me. It feels very like just well executed,
yeah,
on a lot of levels. And it's funny because I've only watched it once because it is so, like, and I own it. I own the movie. I have it because I know I want to watch it again eventually. But it really messes with
it. It takes its toll. I feel like I feel like this will make for an interesting addendum topic because I'm curious, like, what people's, like, if people have a favorite Stephen King storyline or
what,
if there's one
are
that we missed. I mean, obviously, there's many that we missed, but I it would be hard to really go into all of them in depth. But I think this could be an interesting back and forth kind of thing, maybe where we revisit it.
I very much expect to hear from my mom on this.
Hmm.
And if she doesn't comment, I'll be surprised, because I think she has an opinion.
This is a potentially passionate response. Yeah, I'm curious.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, if you've got a favorite Stephen King anything.
Yeah, storybook, film.
Storybook.
Storybook. Your favorite Stephen King storybook.
Well, I think we'll have to come back to those. Yeah?
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Are we out of time?
Probably.
We can come back to it.
We'll be back. I mean, Stephen King's not going anywhere.
He's
still writing. By the time we come back, he'll have written four more things, though. That's the problem. We're never going to keep up pace with him.
And I need to read them.
Yeah.
I haven't read any of them.
You better start. You better read four of them tonight.
Yeah. Okay. Put this in the archive.
Call me an asshole!